Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Yesterday, voters in 14 states participated in Super Tuesday primaries. One-third of the delegates needed to win the Democratic nomination were up for grabs, with Tom Steyer, Pete Buttigieg, and Amy Klobuchar dropping out of the race after former Vice President Joe Biden's stellar victory in South Carolina. Biden surged in the polls, but Bernie Sanders remained way ahead in the state with the most delegates at stake, California. So going into yesterday, pundits were saying it had essentially become a two-person race. The front runner, Bernie Sanders.
When we began this race for the presidency, everybody said it couldn't be done. But tonight, I tell you with absolute confidence, we are going to win the Democratic nomination.
And hot on Sanders' heels, the man who since South Carolina racked up endorsement after endorsement and has now arguably become the front runner, Joe Biden.
Just a few days ago, the press and the pundits had declared the campaign dead. And then came South Carolina, and they had something to say about it. And we're told, well, when he got to Super Tuesday, it'd be over. Well, it may be over for the other guy.
But yesterday was also the first set of contests in which billionaire Michael Bloomberg was on the ballot. And on primary day, he bristled when asked by reporters if he was feeling the pressure to drop out.
Joe's taking votes away from me. And I think that is true.
But you're also taking votes away from Joe Biden.
Well, it goes in both directions. Have you asked Joe whether he's going to drop out?
I cover you.
When you ask him that, then you can call me. I'll take Miss Hughes.
But Mr. Bailey, today going into Super Tuesday to drop out of this race, given
it's the same question he just...
But you didn't really answer it, sir. You've gone after any pressure today.
I have no intention of dropping out. We're in it to win it.
Well, everyone is in it to win it until they aren't. And this hour, we look at what voters had to say yesterday and the impact of those decisions on the future of the race, not just for president, but here in North Carolina on some of the down ballot races. Dr. Michael Bitzer has every intention of helping us through this quest. He is professor of political science and the brains behind the Old North State Politics blog and co-host of the Carolina Campaigns podcast. Everybody has a podcast.
Exactly.
Welcome back.
It's good to be here.
He's in our studio along with WFA political reporter Steve Harrison, who also co-hosts our Inside Politics podcast. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
And joining us from the studios at Duke University is Deandra Rose, an assistant professor at the Sanford School for Public Policy there. Let me ask, do you have a podcast yet?
You know what? I'm realizing that I need one.
We'll give you one by the end of the show. If you'd like to join our conversation, feel free to do so. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter @CharlotteTalks. Before we talk about the races and who won what where, how many people turned out to vote yesterday? And how many do we know yet? How many collectively with early voting and election day voting, Steve, actually came out to vote in North Carolina?
So I think the best way to answer that question is to kind of split the two primaries, Republican and Democratic.
Okay.
On the Democratic side, for president, there were 1.3 million people who voted. That's up 20% from 2016. So if you're a Democrat, that's great news. There was more enthusiasm. But then just to remember, you go back to 2008, the Obama-Hillary primary, people were so excited, 1.6 million. So kind of right in the middle in terms of enthusiasm. And then on the Republican side, I mean, there was no contest, about just under 800,000 people. And 4 years ago, 1.1 million came out for the Trump-Cruz Kasich race.
Yeah. But there were long lines in states like California and Texas, and probably other places too, but certainly California and Texas. And I'm just curious as to whether or not we know why. Was it simply because of malfunctions of voting machines? Was it because of the voter turnout being so high? There were some allegations, I think, in Texas that the legislature purposefully made it difficult, particularly for young people, to vote in that state. I don't know if that's true or not, but some people waited 8 hours to vote.
Yeah, I think that there was a combination of things, but certainly the voter turnout seemed to be impressive both in California and Texas. It may take us a couple days to learn exactly who wins California because of all the mail-in ballots coming in.
So, DeAndre, given the turnout here in North Carolina, the Democratic primary, and what we saw around the country, does it indicate to you that Democrats are fired up about this primary and about this upcoming election?
I think it does. I think that the major takeaway for me is that Democrats have their eyes on the prize of unseating President Trump in November. And we see with a number of different endorsements that have come down post-South Carolina that not only are rank-and-file Democrats working to coalesce to the extent that they can, we also see some of the candidates moving to the side in order to do that.
Mm-hmm. Are the people that are coming out in droves right now and switching over, at least in certain parts of the country, to Joe Biden because they're enthusiastic about Joe Biden, or they think that he can beat Bernie Sanders and that's necessary, or just the fact that the Democrats want to they would vote for a baked potato if they thought that potato could be Donald Trump?
You know, I mean, I think that South Carolina was a really critical turning point for Vice President Biden because there was, I mean, I think if you told people this time last week that he would be, you know, a front runner at this point, there might have been some incredulity. I think that his appeal to African-American voters in the state, especially after racking up Representative Jim Clyburn's endorsement, I mean, that was huge for him. And I think that we're seeing the result of that. We saw it here in North Carolina, and I think we saw it across the southern states.
Joe Biden was dead in the water before South Carolina. Everybody was writing him off. It was going to be Bernie or somebody else, but not Biden. South Carolina embraced him as they have in the past. Jim Clyburn gave him the endorsement. Did you think that this would translate into Biden being swept up in, I think, 9 of the 14 states?
I mean, whatever Jim Clyburn wants, Joe Biden needs to, like, FedEx it today to him. I mean, it doesn't matter what he wants. Get it to him because, as DeAndre said, Jim Clyburn is, you know, such a powerful force in Democratic Party politics in South Carolina. But what South Carolina did was send a message to North Carolina, to Virginia, Alabama, Tennessee, just a wide variety of states. And that signal just really gave Biden the ability to blow out so many states that, as we've all kind of talked about, we would never have expected that kind of performance last night.
And I think I was just going to say one thing. I mean, let's say pretend there was no early voting across the country. Like, Biden would have won by even bigger margins.
Huge.
Because if you look at North Carolina, Biden was going to win just based on early voting. He was ahead of Sanders 28-24. And then it
flipped to 52-24 on election day.
Did it surprise you that the early voting didn't do him in? I mean, a lot of people voted early, and a lot of people had written him off by that time. Why were people who early voting, at least here, still in favor of Biden when it looked like he wasn't going to go anywhere?
Well, about 40% of the ballots were done early, so in person and by mail. That's a lot. That's more than in 2016 when it was only a third. Mm-hmm. But I think what you still had was the fluidity of the race. I mean, Amy Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg, they were all still in it. And then the news happened after South Carolina, the dropouts, the endorsements, and everything just kind of coalesced. I mean, Biden got so much free media attention that he really didn't have to advertise because he didn't have any money, resources to be able to do so.
He had no campaign in the state.
Yeah.
None.
Zero.
So the states, DeAndre, that Biden clearly won, Alabama, Arkansas, Massachusetts, Minnesota, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, Virginia, and he looks like he might be taking Maine. That's still up in the air. Mm-hmm. But what do those states have in common that they went for Biden? Is it simply because they're more conservative and they don't think that Bernie Sanders is their cup of tea? Were there more African Americans who seemed to embrace Joe Biden for whatever reason? What was the key ingredient? What was the secret ingredient there?
I think the desire to win. I mean, I think we see across all of those states substantial constituencies who are a bit more moderate and who really were looking for a more moderate candidate to endorse. And I think the late endorsements by Beto O'Rourke, by Amy Klobuchar, by Pete Buttigieg really helped to steer their supporters to the Biden camp.
Yeah, I was going to ask what role you thought those endorsements played in his victory.
I think they certainly helped, and they gave the energy and the momentum. But as DeAndre said, I mean, the basic common theme, I think, across all the exit polls, at least 60% mm-hmm. of Democrats want to beat Donald Trump.
Right.
That's the core.
My next question was about Elizabeth Warren, and we have a Facebook question from Trish who says, Elizabeth Warren still exists. Senator Warren was way behind in the delegate count and in the polls, yet unlike Mayor Pete and Senator Klobuchar, she did not drop out prior to Super, and Tom Steyer, she did not drop out before Super Tuesday, and she still hasn't, and she probably won't. DeAndre, why?
I think that's right. I mean, so last night, Senator Warren was in Michigan, and I think that was a clear signal that she intends to stay in the game and to make it to the next round of primary competition. And, you know, I'm with Trish in pointing to her outstanding performance in the debates. I mean, she's been a powerful candidate with a clear message. She's been very consistent, especially when, say, Vice President Joe Biden was not. I mean, even last night when he was taking a victory lap, there was a little bit of concern. I mean, at one point he mixed up his wife and his sister during introductions, and it could have been just, you know, the moment, and he was, you know, under with a lot of excitement. But mm-hmm. I think that, you know, there is some concern about, you know, how, quote unquote, with it he is. And I think for Senator Warren, you know, she's been a very sharp candidate throughout the entire process. And I think especially among women who are paying attention to this race, and for many who hope to see a woman advance to candidacy for the Democratic Party, that's disappointing.
Given the given their positions on various issues, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, they're not identical, but they do share a lot of philosophy, and their programs mm-hmm. are slightly different, but they're both aimed in the same direction, essentially. So why was Bernie so much more successful, has been so much more successful, than Elizabeth Warren?
I mean, for one of the things that I've been struck by is when you talk to people in his campaign, they point to it's first of all described as our campaign. It is described as a movement, and there's a lot of inspiration. So the momentum, especially among young voters, who are really interested in seeing some unabashed sweeping change in politics and policy in the United States, I think that that, you know, he's unapologetic about not being a moderate. Yeah. I think that Elizabeth Warren does toe the line differently. You hear her say things like, you know, I'm a capitalist, you know, in a way that we hear Bernie Sanders talking, you know, very forcefully about being a democratic socialist, you know, and this idea of socialism versus capitalism. You know, for me, the fact that this is a major talking point in a major party primary is just astonishing.
She, all the pundits were saying yesterday prior to the results coming in that, Steve, she had to win her home state, Massachusetts, or she would be terribly embarrassed. Well, she didn't win her home state. Joe Biden won her home state. How do you explain that? What does that say to the rest of the country, and what should it say to her?
I mean, that's hard for me to say, like, what it should say, what she should do. But just kind of sitting here, it's tough to see, like, any path forward. You know, I think her best showing is third, right? And in New Hampshire, and no, that was Iowa, even third. I'm sorry. And so I'm not sure, like, where her campaign goes from here. I think another thing, too, is that I do think if she dropped out, I think probably Sanders would receive a lot of her support. Yeah. But I don't necessarily think all of it. I mean, I think that there are a lot of people who are supporting Senator Warren a woman, who want to see a woman as the nominee.
But if she wants her policies passed or a campaign for in the general election, shouldn't she drop out now and give those votes to Bernie, enhancing his numbers?
It could help, but this election, I think we've seen folks splinter all over the place.
We'll talk about that and more when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the results of Super Tuesday here and around the country with Dr. Michael Bitzer, professor of political science at Catawba College, Deandra Rose, assistant professor at the Sanford School for Public Policy at Duke University, and Steve Harrison, our political reporter here at WFAE News and the co-host of our Inside Politics podcast. Let's talk about Michael Bloomberg. He spent a lot of money. How much money did he spend per delegate, Michael? Did you just say off the air?
So if you consider him getting basically 20 delegates out of last night,
right,
it works out to about $25 million a delegate.
Oh. Wow.
Yeah.
Steve, you were worried about the free food he was giving away at the food truck he had set up downtown. That's nothing to him now.
It's nothing to him, but Mike, you talked about this food truck, and it's interesting. It's an interesting story because I think it says a lot about the campaign. So Bloomberg set up his first field office in the country in Charlotte, mm-hmm. spent a lot of money here, hired a lot of people. There was a big push to get black voters, build a coalition. And one event they had last week, they brought a food truck into downtown Charlotte, basically free food. You just text the campaign, some kind of interaction. And, you know, I went there, and, like, there's no one there. I mean, they had a few people who kind of stopped by to get a free dinner, and it was mostly campaign workers. And it was just, you kind of see a moment like that, and you think, like, okay, this is not going to end well.
Yeah. So he had his first taste of voter justice in yesterday's primaries, I guess. As we heard a couple minutes ago, he was constantly accosted. I saw several clips on networks yesterday, all at different locations, of reporters asking him one question, and that was, are you going to drop out? Was that a fair question? I mean, this guy has pumped, as you pointed out, millions of dollars.
Half a billion total.
Okay, yeah. So when you've pumped that much money into your campaign, should you be expected to look at the tea leaves and say, okay, I'm getting out before the first vote for you is cast?
One would think that winning only America Samoa should be a signal. But, you know, Mike Bloomberg is successful. And when he sets his mind on something, he's going to stay on it. Now, I think the realization is what is probably working through the campaign today. And if nothing else, he is a data guy. He looks at data. He sees where the patterns and the trends are. And the patterns and trends just don't portend to him doing well.
So should he drop out now and throw his money behind one candidate or the other, or should he just stay in? Because God knows he can afford to stay in as long as he wants.
I mean, if he's got money to burn, go for it. I've got some ideas that if he wants to throw $25 million to me, I could help.
Money doesn't seem to matter in this election, Deandra. $17 million is what I think Tom Steyer spent in South Carolina on television commercials, and we see how well he did there, and he dropped out instantly after the South Carolina primary. Michael Bloomberg has spent even more money and will continue to spend, has promised to spend even more money, even if he's not the nominee, for whoever the Democratic nominee is, because his goal is to beat Donald Trump. Does money seem to matter in this contest, though?
You know, the quote that's resonated with me is that money is not momentum, apparently. And in a political context where money is increasingly important, I think this is somewhat reassuring for people who are really concerned about democracy and, you know, equality right now in 2020. And so I think that right now we're seeing just how powerful the vote is, and the fact that even though, you know, individual candidates have the prerogative to pump as much money as they will, as much of their personal money as they will, into these races, that it is not money that will lead to, you know, that's not where the buck stops.
Yeah. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Steve, I think this is the first time that a candidate has waited to get into the race until Super Tuesday. And even though this candidate, Michael Bloomberg, has a lot of money, was that a miscalculation, do you think?
Yes. I mean, okay. I'm not saying it would have turned out any differently.
Right.
But I just think, you know, I mean, you see candidates who do the strategy of, like, well, we're going to minimize Iowa and focus on New Hampshire, et cetera. You know, you see, like, but everybody shows up, at least in some place, you know, in some way in the first four. Mm-hmm. And it just...
And you get the kinks worked out of your campaign. I mean, you know, you spend a year in Iowa, you spend a year in New Hampshire and South Carolina and Nevada trying to get your campaign focused and ready.
Yeah.
And that first debate showed that Mike Bloomberg was nowhere near ready for the onslaught that came to him. The second debate, but, you know, if he makes it into the third and whatnot, it's just, you know, you spend the time becoming a candidate. You can't buy that with money.
So DeAndre, Bernie has the progressive wing of the Democratic Party under his in his arms, I guess. Joe Biden has the moderates and African Americans. Bloomberg is challenged, I think, when it comes to African Americans. So who is his constituency?
You know, I think after last night, we're all asking that question. And I hope that I imagine that he's asking himself that question as well. He was hoping to appeal to suburban voters, to older voters. He wanted to be the alternative to Joe Biden. And I think that after South Carolina, we saw that people were reassured about Vice President Biden's candidacy and came back over to him. And so I think, you know, had South Carolina not been as empowering for the Biden campaign, then we might have seen Bloomberg rack up a little more support last night.
Kirby emails, Bloomberg is this year's John Connolly. Well, you have to be old to remember John Connolly. If you don't get the reference, you can look it up. He spent, I think, $11 million back in 1980 and won only one delegate. Todd on Facebook says, the fix is in to show Sanders the door and put Biden in the presidential race. That has been the allegation for quite a while, that the Democratic machine,
the establishment
was not going to allow this progressive socialist Democrat, who doesn't even necessarily call himself a Democrat, to be the party's nominee. But when you look at what happened yesterday in Super Tuesday, is that a fair assessment, given the fact that the voters said no in nine of the 14 states?
I mean, if you look here in North Carolina, the early vote, Bernie Sanders got 24%. On Election Day, he got 24%. He ended up with 24%.
Mm-hmm.
You don't run a revolution with a quarter of the vote.
And that's not the Democratic machine. What did you call it? Not the machine.
The establishment.
The establishment.
Yeah, that's, I mean,
that's not them. That's the voters.
That's the voters. The voters are speaking.
I was going to say, before the show, you and I were talking about going through like county by county results. So you look at Orange County, which is Chapel Hill.
Right.
So that is Bernie country, right? He got, I'm looking here, 18,250 votes 4 years ago against Hillary. Went down to 12,600 this time. So, I mean, it was obviously more candidates this time. The vote's going to be split. But if you can't come close to matching your totals in Chapel Hill, again, is that a way to build a revolution?
And it's the same story across the South, because in the last Super Tuesday race, when Bernie ran against Hillary, he didn't win any state on Super Tuesday with a black population over 21%. This year, mm-hmm. North Carolina and Virginia's black population is at 27%. I think Arkansas is at 25%. Alabama around 40%. Did he have a ghost of a chance in the South, DeAndre, because he lost all of those states?
You know, I think he staked a lot of his resources and energy in the South. I mean, last week he was here in North Carolina in Goldsboro at the Greenleaf Baptist Church with Reverend Barber. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about, you know, addressing poverty and health care for all and really working to resonate with African-American voters in particular. But he couldn't make good on his campaign's promise to be a movement that would expand the electorate. And so, you know, he was really banking on being able to get out the vote among young voters, among African-American and Latino voters, and he wasn't able to expand his constituency in the way that would have been necessary. And, you know, thinking about youth voters in particular, his appeal among young voters, yes, he did get the highest proportion. Like, he did really well among young voters, but he wasn't expanding that segment of the population to the extent that Joe Biden was able to appeal to and resonate with older voters.
I was curious last Sunday night, when Pete Buttigieg announced he was dropping out of the race, as to why, given the fact that he really only lost badly in one place, and that was South Carolina. And then the Super Tuesday results came out, and you look at the results of his voter totals, and they were miserable. everywhere. So it's clearly somebody in his campaign knew what was coming down the pike. And I had a question about that. Now I've forgotten what it is. but I really have forgotten what it is. But, I know what it was. The mayor of Columbia endorsed Pete Buttigieg.
Steve Benjamin.
Yes. Charlotte Mayor Lyles endorsed Mike Bloomberg. We have a question from Dennis, who emails, do you think this will impact her mayoral pursuits going forward? She endorsed a loser.
Oh, here. Mayor Lyles?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. I think it was a really awkward endorsement. It was really hard, and it was difficult for the mayor. I mean, she didn't really go out and do any events for Bloomberg that I could see. It was kind of like put out a press release, gone, silent. Yeah. But I think that Mayor Lyles is a really popular politician. Yeah. Republicans like her. Democrats like her. I think if she wants to run for higher office.
As you recall, when she made that endorsement, her daughter, Aisha, took issue with that and put out her own public statement. She disagreed vehemently with her mother about the Bloomberg endorsement. And she tweeted this morning, Aisha tweeted this morning, "My mom should take my advice more often."
And that was such a gentle tweet than the first one.
And boomers versus millennials. Here we go.
Oh, gosh. Yesterday afternoon, 538.com had selected the likeliest outcome, and we're taking different scenarios into question. I watched this video on the website before the vote totals were coming in, and they pretty much said exactly what was going to happen with this vote count in all these states in which Joe Biden won. It didn't seem that Sanders had any path to winning Super Tuesday overall. Do you think the Sanders campaign knows that, knew it going into this?
I think after Saturday's endorsement and then the South Carolina win by Biden, I think they really had to start looking at the momentum and the energy behind Biden and really start to think, okay, a week ago, we would have had a cushion, particularly coming out of California. Now we can't bet on it. And in fact, based on some of the delegate counts that I've seen, it's now a new front runner, and that's Joe Biden in the delegate count.
And Elizabeth Warren is still in the race. And I heard this morning on NPR that some are saying that she intends to stay in the race until the convention. She's either looking for a brokered convention, in which case she, with some delegates, would have some sway over something, the platform, or maybe who the vice president is, or whatever it may be. Do you think a contested convention will happen? Or is it, if this Super Tuesday and the South Carolina results continue to be replicated going forward, is that just out of the question? I don't know who to take that to.
I'm doubtful that there's going to be a contested convention. Okay. I think
rats.
And
sorry.
I think either Bloomberg.
Everybody wants one.
Either Bloomberg gets out, or the next round of voting, his support drops even more, and it goes to Biden. And
chime in on that, DeAndre. What do you think?
I think that for the party, a contested convention could be problematic.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of the endorsements we're seeing and that we've seen in the last couple of days speak to Democrats, those who are in elected office and who have been running, their commitment to settling as much of the dust as possible before going into the convention in hopes of removing this sense that there is the establishment that's, putting a thumb on the scale for, the non-Bernie candidates in order to start to focus on President Trump. And I think, the goal for the Democratic Party, the strategy ought to be unifying as much as possible, as early as possible.
Well, there's a question here from Dandy on Facebook. I'm curious how Biden is going to unify the progressives. Does the party even need them? Does the party need the progressives? Can they win with just the moderates?
I would contend that they certainly don't need a fall off in particular states of the progressive wing. I think at some point, if Biden is indeed the nominee and he locks up the requisite 1991 delegates, I think you will see Barack Obama come out and try to begin a real push for party unity.
But can you have the kind of intensity that one presumes you would need to beat the intensity that Donald Trump brings to these contests? Because of his exceptional rallies that he has, et cetera. If you don't have the progressives, and they're not just there voting for Biden, but they're there enthusiastically voting for the nominee.
Yeah. And I don't know if a vice presidential candidate can do that. But, you know, a little bit of juice.
That could be the balance to the mm-hmm. ticket of bring in a progressive as vice president.
I'll tell you who wants a I'm not sure that Bloomberg wants a contested convention, but let's see what he says, because he was asked yesterday if he wanted one.
Well, I don't think that I can win any other ways, but contested convention is a democratic process.
Hmm. He's not alone in that hope. Of course, Elizabeth Warren is hoping for that. And would Bernie Sanders? I guess Bernie Sanders would want that, too, if he doesn't continue to make headway in this. NBC Super Tuesday exit polls revealed yesterday, Deandra, that when asked if the next president should be more of a return to Barack Obama's policies, 44% of Democrats said return to Obama. 38% said that person should be more liberal, while 11% said that person should be more conservative. Now, when asked last weekend that same question, 53% of South Carolinians said more like Obama. Yesterday, 56% of North Carolinians agreed with those people in South Carolina. That means Democrats here want a candidate who can beat Trump, but they also want one who is a moderate. Will that continue to be the case as we move out of the South, do you think?
I think so. I mean, I think especially looking toward November, we're seeing Democrats recognize that appealing not only to the party faithful who participate in primaries, but also reaching out to and appealing to those who will come out for the general election and hopefully picking off some votes from the Republican Party, people who, you know, maybe are not comfortable with calling themselves Democrats or who identify as independents, an increasingly large number in the U.S., who are, you know, never Trump Republicans. So I think that pushing for a more moderate stance, for a more moderate ticket, that also doesn't relinquish the support of the party faithful, the people who are a little more progressive on the left, that's the objective.
I thought watching the Donald Trump White House for the last 3 years was giving me whiplash, but this contest is too. I can't remember.
Welcome to being a political scientist.
Yeah, maybe I'm wrong, but I can't remember a contest like this on either party where the lead not only changed, but it changes dramatically and surprisingly. Am I right or wrong on that? Just my imagination?
No, Deandra can certainly correct me. Yeah. I don't recall this intense of a roller coaster ride.
Right.
I mean, we've had candidates, Bill Clinton in 92, you know, claim to be the comeback kid when he finished third in New Hampshire and then finally started his way towards the nomination. But this has been all over the place in terms of feeling about how this race is panning out.
When we come back, Deandra, I'll ask you what that means. Since it's been all over the place, what should we be taking from that? We'll do that in a moment. We have to take a break. We're here with Deandra Rose from Duke University, Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, and Steve Harrison from WFAE News. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. How will the Republican National Convention impact Charlotte? And how will Charlotte play a role in the 2020 presidential election? We have the answers on Inside Politics, the RNC in Charlotte, the newest podcast from WFAE. Listen to the latest episode on WFAE.org/InsidePolitics and wherever you find podcasts. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Michael Bitzer is here, professor of political science, the author of the Old North State Politics blog, and the genius behind Carolina Campaign's podcast from Catawba College.
You're too kind.
Thank you very much. Deandra Rose is assistant professor at the Sanford School for Public Policy at Duke University, where she is this morning. And Steve Harrison is our political reporter here at WFAE News and the co-host of the Inside Politics podcast. So we were talking just prior to the break about this roller coaster in the Democratic primary 3 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, whenever it was, yesterday afternoon at 5. I don't know. Pete Buttigieg seems like he was neck and neck with Bernie Sanders, and then suddenly he's gone, completely gone. Then it looks like Bernie Sanders is at the front of the pack. Now he's way down in the bottom, only taking, I think, 3 states yesterday. What does this roller coaster ride mean? What should we take, if anything, from this, Deandra?
I mean, my sense is that it's not over till it's over could be an effective takeaway. But I do think that for the Democrats, they ought to recognize that a lot of people are just tired of all of this. I mean, the roller coaster is a bit nauseating at times. And I think especially looking at the past few years of unconventional White House politics and unconventional primary race, people really do want to return to a sense of normalcy. And they want to see the adults in the room take the lead of government. And I think that's what people will be looking for as we move toward November. Yeah.
Betty Davis comes to mind. Nobody
Indeed.
Knows who she is, but
no,
anymore.
Yeah.
Buckle up. It's going to be a bumpy ride. if you combine those 44% of voters in the Super Tuesday states that want to return to Obama policies with the 11% who want things to become more conservative, that's 55% of Democratic voters to the 38% who want things to be more liberal, more progressive, more Bernie. Mm-hmm. Those are the Bernie voters. Are there other states with primaries coming up that could move that number more toward Bernie Sanders, or are the southern states really more representative of what the rest of the country wants and the exhaustion I think everybody feels, Republican and Democrat, with what's been happening for 3 years?
I think Michigan is going to be a critical test. Remember 4 years ago, it looked like Clinton was on her way to the nomination. Bernie was constantly coming in second. And then he won Michigan. Mm-hmm. And I think if you look back, that was maybe a canary in the coal mine of an indicator that, hey, maybe progressives are starting to voice their concerns and really start to have an impact. And I think for the debate, you know, I think that there's one before Michigan. If there is a debate, Warren doesn't, we've talked about Warren not getting the attention. I think if potentially Bloomberg is not on the stage, that sets her up to go after Biden and be more like Sanders. And that dynamic is going to be interesting to see how it plays out.
We haven't talked a lot about the other person in this race, even though he's not a Democrat, Donald Trump. He came to Charlotte Monday night, had a rally at Bojangles Coliseum, which evidently was incredibly well attended.
Yeah, so we talked earlier in the show that 800,000 people voted in the Republican primary, which was down from 4 years ago. Not a big surprise. But like you said, this Bojangles rally was really crazy. He had one in 2018 for Mark Harris before the midterms, and it was full. But this was at a whole nother level. I mean, if you weren't in line by 2 o'clock, you weren't going to get in. There were probably a few thousand people who did not get in who watched in the parking lot.
How many seats in that arena?
9,000 to 10,000.
Okay.
So there were a few thousand outside watching on a big screen TV. I mean, it was like I had to park on the other side of Independence, walk 15 minutes to get to the arena. So there is still a lot of enthusiasm.
Wow.
For the president.
You know, when Barack Obama had his convention here, they were planning to use the Bank of America Stadium for his acceptance speech. And they canceled it that afternoon because the threat of thunderstorms, which never materialized. So they moved everything back into the convention hall. But it would have been an enormous group of people in that stadium. And I think this morning it was announced that the Republican convention will not be using Bank of America Stadium. Clearly the president could fill that thing. Why not?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think part of it is, there's some kind of details that we don't know, right? They said they're not going to use it. Mm-hmm. But again, Bojangles is owned by the city. Spectrum Center is owned by the city. So that's all kind of part of the contract. Bank of America Stadium, of course, is owned by the Panthers owner. So it's possible, and this is all speculation. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't have the rights to it.
Right.
So, but
they could rent it.
They could rent it, but is it too much money? Is it?
Oh, come on.
I mean, you're right. Now, I guess I'm saying, is David Tepper interested in renting it? I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, they could certainly fill it.
So yesterday we see Joe Biden. The two B's are killing me. We see Joe Biden replicating essentially what happened to him in South Carolina. Was it a clash, DeAndre, yesterday between the older, more moderate voters in the Democratic Party, Biden supporters, and younger, more progressive voters, Sanders supporters? And if so, how will the younger Sanders supporters react if he doesn't end up being the nominee?
I think that's a central question, too, that will shape what we see coming down the pike in the next few months. And I think that for the Democratic Party, for party leaders and for the eventual nominee, they need to take seriously this level of discomfort that young voters are demonstrating with the establishment and with the status quo. And so the choice of a vice president is going to be critical, I think, for especially if Joe Biden is the nominee. And so for me, so I would say for doing a couple of things, appealing to young voters, appealing to voters of color in particular. So thinking about this primary race, it began as one of the most diverse Democratic primaries in history in terms of the range of candidates who were put out initially. And it's dwindled to, you know, two older men in their 70s, essentially.
Yeah.
And I think that in order to really appeal to the broad Democratic constituency and many people who you know, really want to see substantial change, especially in regards to representation and equality, signaling that they're in tune to this with a vice presidential nominee, somebody like Stacey Abrams, for example, will be important.
Yeah. One of the networks had a reporter at a polling place on the campus of the University of Texas. And they literally, it was a long report because the reporter walked the line to get in to the polling place, which went around this enormous campus building. It was enormous. And it took her probably 3 or 4 minutes to walk the line. And those people had been in line for hours. And she stopped by and she talked to a couple of these. They were all students, all of them, to these young women who were standing there. And she said, "Who are you voting for?" "We don't know. We'll decide when we get in." On the one hand, that sounds incredibly, I don't know, cavalier.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, they said, because she said, "Well, then why are you here if you don't know who you're going to vote for?" She said, "Well, because it's your civic duty," which actually made me feel good about those.
Sure.
I don't have a question. I just wanted to bring it up.
No, I think Deandra is exactly right. This election, if you look at the voter pool in North Carolina, 36% of the registered voters are under the age of 40. That means millennials and Gen Z. And if they have any inclination of shifting not just the state, but the nation as a whole, they will need to show up at numbers comparable to Gen Xers and boomers. And if that happens, there's a whole new dynamic that plays out in this country's politics, I think.
Jennifer, and who does that favor, Democrats or Republicans?
Democrats.
Jennifer on Facebook, "Why does this feel like a repeat of 2016? Bernie would have beaten Trump 4 years ago, and he can do it now. Why is the Democratic Party backing another person who cannot win?" Well, is the party backing Biden or are voters backing Biden? That's number one. And do you think, does anybody around this table, including you, Deandra, who's sitting at another table someplace, could he have won? Could Bernie have won against Donald Trump last time? Deandra, I'll start with you.
Okay. I mean, so the sense that, again, the Democratic Party has put its thumb on the scales for Vice President Biden is something that we're seeing a lot of young people, they're suspicious of this and of the establishment.
But how can they be? The voters, the vote speaks for itself.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's what Tom Perez, the Democratic Party chair, was saying last night in a number of statements, is that, you know, the voters have spoken. And if anything, the party has worked to provide a more inclusive primary structure this time around to reassure people that it really is a democratic process. So, you know, I don't think that the data support that assumption, but, you know, it will remain to be seen. I think the level of transparency that the party provides reassure people, especially the millennial voters, that the process is fair.
Because Dan, I'll let you jump in, but Dan on Facebook says average Joes from across the country pick Joe Biden, not the establishment. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, I was just going to say, like, when AOC endorse Bernie, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
When Buttigieg and Klobuchar endorse Biden establishment bad.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, well, I mean, I do struggle kind of like trying to figure that one out.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it may be a time for a changing of the guard, but not according to most of the voters so far. Now, I have a question about California, because Bernie Sanders is ahead in California, but he still hasn't taken the state, as far as I can tell. I'm looking at the New York Times right now, and he is ahead by 8.7 points, but they still haven't called the state for him. There are a lot of Latino voters in California, and Latino voters have been described as the angriest among the voting population because of what the Trump administration has been doing to people at the border. And they are allegedly going to be the largest minority in the country. But if he can't win California clearly and decisively, because he has been a favorite of Latino voters, what does that say about Bernie Sanders? Michael?
Well, I mean, I'm looking at the exit poll from California. According to the exit poll, Hispanic Latinos went 55% for Bernie Sanders.
Right.
If you look at African American voters in California, 38% for Joe Biden. So that constituency is a critical constituency for this multiracial, multi-ethnic coalition that is the modern Democratic Party.
But there are lots of Latino voters in Texas, mm-hmm. and Joe Biden won Texas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and you look at Florida. There's going to be, when that Democratic primary comes around, that constituency is going to be critical.
And Bernie Sanders didn't do himself any favors with his comments about Castro, particularly in the Miami area.
Particularly in the Miami area, but you also have to look at the Orlando, the I-4 corridor area of particularly from Puerto Rico in that area. So it's a critical constituency that's only growing in its influence.
Right. Michelle emails, I think Bloomberg knows a lot of Republicans would vote for him. They can't vote for him in the primary, of course, and he can't say he's counting on them because it would seem like he didn't value Democratic constituents. What about that? Some Republicans could have crossed over. You could certainly cross over in North Carolina. You could have crossed over in South Carolina.
If you were registered unaffiliated in North Carolina.
All right. So what does that say? I mean, do you think if he were to stay in this race that Republicans would vote for him when they couldn't hold their nose and vote for Biden or Bernie?
It's hard for me to imagine a Republican going over into a Democratic primary and voting for Mike Bloomberg.
Will he run as an independent? That's a Facebook comment or a question from Kenny.
I think he wants Donald Trump out, and he will pump whatever money is needed and avoid the splintering that Jill Stein and others did in 2016.
So there were five Democratic candidates running for U.S. Senate yesterday here in North Carolina. Prior to yesterday, Cal Cunningham and Erica Smith were the front runners, had been leading the pack. Erica had received some unsolicited help from from a Republican group, the Faith and Power PAC, and it didn't do her any good.
No. So what you're referring to is, yeah, there was a Republican PAC that spent about $3 million on TV ads for her. I mean, and if you look at the ads closely, they were kind of funny because they weren't authorized by her campaign. So they had really no video footage of her. It was all like this grainy cell phone video they'd thrown together. And they did it trying to boost her. And then when it kind of appeared that Cunningham was going to win anyway, the take was, well, we forced Cunningham to play defense and spend a lot of money to win his primary. Yeah. And there was a lot of hard feelings in this race because Washington Democrats. I mean, this is a case where the establishment did put their thumb on the scale. They clearly did and favored Cal Cunningham. But
and meanwhile, Stephen Law, who's the former chief of staff to the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, criticized Democrats for spending $13 million in that race in what was described as a rescue mission for Cal Cunningham. And he also described Cunningham as a lackluster candidate. Mr. Law also runs the Senate Leadership Fund. It's a super PAC for Republicans. Did his statements have any truth to them, or were they just pure politics?
Guess what? The Senate Leadership PAC helped to fund the Faith and Power PAC.
Okay. Okay. And on the Republican side, incumbent Senator Tom Tillis had three challengers. This was a cakewalk for him, right?
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
It was. And I was just going to say one interesting thing about Senator Tillis, going back to the rally at Bojangles with the president continues to kind of yank his chain. He will say great things about him, and the crowd will cheer, but right before that, he will say, Senator Tillis and I, we haven't always gotten along. I mean, he just continues to remind him who's the boss.
Who's the boss? Wow. Who's next? Who votes next?
We get Michigan, Georgia, we'll have Florida, Ohio, all of those coming
up. And Michigan is the test. Is that what you're saying?
I think so. It'll be an interesting case study to see how this three-way race plays out.
Dr. Michael Bitzer, professor of political science at Catawba College, Steve Harrison from WFAE News, and DeAndra Rose, first-time contestant here, did well, assistant professor at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.